Germination happens fast. Nile finishes his space opera. Some part of the elongated boy in the futuristic wheelchair still wants to give the game away for free. But there comes a moment, as there always does in the game itself, when you must turn your pretty backwater sector of the universe into a revenue stream. Publishing the game requires a company, if only a fake one. Corporate HQ is his ground floor efficiency with access ramp near El Camino in Redwood City. The business needs a name, even if the entire outfit is nothing but a crippled 20-something Indian-American rolling around like a bundle of twigs in a dog cart. But naming a company turns out to be harder than coding up a planet. For 3 days, Nile plays with portmanteaus and neologisms, all of which come up short or have already been taken. He's sucking on his dinner, a cinnamon toothpick, and staring at some faked-up letterhead when the word Redwood pops out of his return address. It's like someone whispers the obvious answer into his ear. Using a paint program, he mocks up a logo, a ripoff of Stanford's fearsome tree, and Semper Virens is born. He calls the company's first release The Sylvan Prophecies. With state-of-the-art DTP software, he designs an ad. At the top of the page, he centers the words, "There's a whole new planet right next door." Then Nile runs the ad in the back of comics and computer magazines across the country. A disc dupe outfit over in Menlo Park pumps out 3,000 floppies. He hires 2 ex-Stanford friends to get the game into stores up and down both coasts. Within a month, The Sylvan Prophecies sells out. Nile dupes more discs. They sell out again. He's stunned that so many rigs out there meet the game's minimum specs. Word of mouth keeps spreading. Revenues flow in, and soon there's too much work for him to handle alone. He signs a 5-year lease on a former dentist's suite. He hires a secretary and calls her the office manager. He hires a hacker and calls him the lead programmer. He signs a guy with an accounting degree who metamorphoses into a business manager. Assembling the team feels like building up the home planet in The Sylvan Prophecies. From scores of applicants, he hires the ones who flinch the least when they see his stick-figure body sprouting from the motorized chair. Astonishingly, the new employees prefer cash up front to shares in the future. It's a total failure of imagination. They haven't a clue where their species is headed. He tries to talk them around, but they all elect for safety and cash. Soon, the business manager breaks it to Nile. It's not enough to pretend he's a company. He has to incorporate for real. Semper Virens becomes a legal person. Nile goes to bed at night, dreaming of branching and spreading. It's a brand new industry with an unlimited growth curve. He needs only a few market hits, each one compounding the success of the previous. Then he'll make the world over, the way it was shown to him in a flash by alien life forms in the wild terrarium of Stanford's inner court. By day, when he isn't learning how to run a company, Nile keeps on coding. Programming still amazes him. Declare a variable. Specify a procedure. Call each well-formed routine to do its part inside larger, cleverer, more capable structures, like organelles building up a cell. And up from simple instructions emerges an entity with autonomous behavior. Words into action. It's the planet's next new thing. Coding, he's still a boy of 7, with the whole world of living possibilities coming up the stairs in his father's arms. The first game is still selling at a healthy clip when Semper Virens releases the sequel. The new Sylvan Prophecies employs unbelievable verisimilitude in an astonishing 256 colors. There's real packaging now, with professional artwork, though the gameplay is the same old exploration and trading set in a glorious new higher-res galaxy. The public doesn't care that it's a rehash. The public can't get enough. They love the world's open-ended nature. There's no real way to win the game. As with running a business, the point is to keep playing for as long as possible. The new Sylvan Prophecies tops the charts, even before its ancestor falls out of the top 10. Players post messages in online bulletin boards about wild creatures they find on backwater planets, odd, unpredictable combinations of animal, vegetable, and mineral. Lots of people find baiting the game's flora and fauna more entertaining than finding the treasure at the galaxy's core. Together, the two games make more money than many Hollywood movies, on a much lower outlay. Nilay plows all profits back into the third installment, already more ambitious than the previous two games combined. When The Sylvan Revelation appears 9 months later, it lists for an outrageous $50. But for growing numbers of people, that's a small price to pay for a transformative experience that didn't even exist 2 years ago. A big publisher called Digit Arts offers to purchase the brand. The arrangement makes all kinds of sense. Professionals would take over sales and distribution of all future products, freeing Semper Virens to devote itself to development. Nilay doesn't want to run a company, he wants to make worlds. The Digit Arts offer would guarantee his freedom and keep him in state-of-the-art wheelchairs forever. The night he agrees, in principle, to the deal, Nilay can't sleep. He lies in his adjustable bed, trimmed by his mother's runner of quilted storage pockets and arched over by a steel grab bar wrapped in foam padding. Around midnight, his legs start spasming like an ambulatory person's. He needs to get up. That would be easier with the caregiver, but Gina doesn't come for another several hours. A button press brings the bed's head all the way upright. He wraps his arm around the right-hand vertical post and flings his left up in front of the horizontal bar. Muscle wastage has left his forearms looking like pared pieces of driftwood. His elbows flare out in swollen knots. It takes all his strength to lever himself into a seated position. His shoulders shake, and he squeezes past that moment when he always threatens to flop back onto the bed. He rocks for a while, to tilt his torso forward enough to fling both arms behind him and buttress himself upright. Step one. Of 52 or so, depending on how you count. His sweatpants are down around his knees in the ready position, where he keeps them when the calf is in. He leans as far as he can, bends almost double, so that the weight of his head and shoulders stays put long enough for him to plant his hands forward near his butt. His right arm slips under his left thigh. There's precious little meat left there as well. None, really. But it testifies to the baggage of his legs that they're still anchor enough to brace against and keep his shriveled torso upright. He grapples up the sweats and falls back onto his left elbow. Up swings the limp drawbridge of the leg. His butt lifts enough for him to fumble the seat of the pants over himself. Success is a while in coming. The leg drops, he falls back on his protruding shoulder blades, and he's prostrate all over again. Craning himself up once more with the bar-hung stirrup, he repeats the process on his right until the sweats are drawn tightly squarely over his waist. Smoothing out the leggings on both sides takes time, but time in the middle of the night is an ample resource. Then a grab of the overhead bar, and, stabilized again, reaching out to one of the many hanging hooks filled with gear, he snags the U-shaped canvas sling and, in 100 small increments, spreads it out on the bed around his body's upright stem. Each leg gets wrapped underneath in a strap pulled up through the middle. He stabs out again and spears the head of the winch, drags it across its own horizontal brace beam until it's positioned directly above. All four sling loops go over the winch's latches, two per side. He pops the remote in his mouth, and holding the straps in place, bites down on the power button until the winch lifts him upright. He affixes the remote to the sling and attaches the catheter's urine sac from the side of the bed. Holding the hose in his teeth to free both hands, he attaches the bag to the satchel he has wrapped himself in. Then he presses the winch button again, holds on, and goes airborne. There's always that moment as he scooches sideways through the air from bed to waiting chair when the whole precarious system wavers. He has shifted wrong before and come down hard, smacking metal struts and crashing to the floor in pain and urine. Tonight's ride, though, is error-free. The seat of the wheelchair must be adjusted, the wheels repositioned, but he sticks the landing. There, in the chair, he reverses all the steps, detaches the winch, hangs the bag, and, like Houdini, slips free of the sling underneath him without ever lifting. Donning the cassock is easy. The shoes, though slip-on and big as a clown's, are less so. But he's mobile now, zipping about by joystick and throttle, as easily as doing Immelmanns in a flight simulator. The whole ordeal has taken only a little over 30 minutes. Another 10, and he's out by the van, waiting for the hydraulic floor of the lift to lower to the ground. He rolls his chair onto the steel square and rides it up. He rolls through the open hull into the emptied-out cabin. The lift retracts. The doors slide shut, and he positions his chair in front of a console where pedal and brake are levers at waist level that even wasted arms can operate. Several dozen more commands in this algorithm of liberty, and he parks the van, exits, and rolls into the Stanford inner quad. He spins 360, surveying, surrounded again by those otherworldly life forms the way he was 6 years earlier. All those creatures from another galaxy, far, far away. Dove tree, jacaranda, desert spoon, camphor flame, empress, Kurajong, red mulberry. He remembers how they whispered to him about a game he was destined to make, a game played by countless people worldwide, a game that puts the players smack in the middle of a living, breathing jungle filled with potential only dimly imaginable. Tonight, the trees are tight-lipped, refusing to tell him anything. He drums his fingers on his shriveled thighs. Waits, listening, for even longer than it took him to get here. No one's around. The moon is a blazing telephone that anyone on Earth might call him on, simply by looking up and seeing what he sees. He wills the menagerie of trees to give him a sign. The extraterrestrial beings wave their bizarre branches. The collective tapping in the air nags at him. Memory rises inside like sap, and now, it's as if the blowing, bending branches point him outward, behind the quad, out to Escondido, then down Panama Street, past Roble. He heads where the waving sends him. Off to the south, the rounded tops of the Santa Cruz Mountains rise above the campus roofs. And now he remembers a day, half his life ago and more, walking a forest trail on that ridge with his father, and coming across a spectacular, monstrous redwood, a lone Methuselah that somehow escaped the loggers. He sees now. It's the tree he must have named his company after, and without a second thought, he knows he must consult it. The switchbacks up Sandhill Road, harrowing at noon, are deadly in the dark. He tacks back and forth, as if in one of those flying pods you can build at Tech Level 29 in the Sylvan Prophecies. The road is empty at this hour. No one to see the emaciated Ent with the worthless legs piloting a modified van with his freakish bony fingers. At the top of the ridge, on Skyline, a road named for the cableway that stripped these hills bare to build San Francisco, he turns right. That much he remembers. If memories change the pathways of the brain, then the trail must still be there. It's just a matter of waiting for the wild things to emerge out of the understory. He drives through the tunnel of second growth, which has returned enough in 100 years to fool him in this pitch black into thinking it's virgin forest. A pull-off on the right triggers enough recognition to make him stop. There's a flashlight in the glove compartment. He rides the van's lift down to the spongy earth and waits, unsure how to pilot the chair, however fat-tired and ruggedized, down the path in front of him. But that's what this point-and-click adventure wants. For 100 yards of trail, he's fine. Then his left tire hits a wet declivity and slips. He guns the joystick, trying to power through. He backs up and spins, hoping to pop out laterally. The tire kicks up mud and digs in. He waves the flashlight in front of him. Shadows rear up like lunging specters. Every snapped branch sounds like the work of extinct apex predators. A car engine crescendos up from nothing, far away down skyline. Neely screams at the top of his skinny lungs and waves the beam like a crazy man, but the car blasts past. He sits in total darkness, wondering how mankind ever survived such a place. Some hiker will find him once the sun comes up. Or the day after. Who knows how much traffic this trail gets? A screeching comes from behind. He whirls the flashlight but can't turn far enough. His heart takes a while to return to baseline. When it does, he must empty the filled catheter bag onto the ground, as far from his wheels as he can reach. Then he sees it, woven into the other shadows less than 12 yards in front of him. He knows how he missed it. It's too big to make sense of, too big to credit as a living thing. It's a triple-wide door of darkness into the side of the night. The beam goes no more than the smallest way up the endless trunk, and up the trunk runs, straight up, beyond comprehension, an immortal collective ecosystem. Semper Virens. Underneath the stupendous life, a tiny man and his even tinier son look up. Together, they're shorter than the buttress growing out of this thing's root system. Nile watches, knowing what's to come. The memory is as dense as if it were just encoded in him. The father bends back and raises his hands to the sky.
Vishnu's fig, Nileji, come back to swallow us.
The standing boy must have laughed then, as the sitting one wants to now.
Pita, don't be crazy. It's a redwood.
The father lays it out. All the world's trunks come from the same root and are rushing outward down the spreading branches of the one tree, trying for something.
Think of the code that made this gigantic thing, my Nile. How many cells inside? How many programs is it running? What do they all do? Where are they trying to reach?
Lights go on all over the inside of Nile's cranium. And there, in the dark wood, waving his tiny beam and feeling a hum come from the towering black column, he knows the answer. The branch wants only to go on branching. The point of the game is to keep playing. He can't possibly sell the company. There's a bit of ancestral code already present in the earliest programs he and his father wrote that has yet to have its way with him. He sees the next project, and it's the simplest thing. Like evolution, it reuses all the old successful parts of everything that has come before. Like evolution, it just means unfolding. Now he can't afford to wait until tomorrow to be found. He has another brainstorm, much smaller but more immediate. He lifts the cassock off his back and drops it on the ground in front of his stuck tire. A push of the joystick, and he is free, up the path and into the van, where he rides bare-chested via 1,000 steps and subroutines back down to Redwood City and his workstation. The next day, he calls Digit Arts and breaks off the deal. Their property lawyers threaten and bellow, but the only thing they really wanted from the merger was him. He is Semper Viren's only capital worth acquiring. Without his goodwill, the deal means nothing. With the merger broken off, he assembles his staff into the conference room and tells them how the next project will go. The player will start in an uninhabited corner of a freshly assembled new Earth. He'll be able to dig mines, cut down trees, plow fields, construct houses, build churches and markets and schools, anything his heart desires and his legs can reach. He'll travel down all the spreading branches of an enormous technology tree, researching everything from stoneworking to space stations, free to follow any ethos to make whatever culture floats his state-of-the-art boats. But there's a kicker. Other people, real people on the other end of modems, will each be furthering their own culture in other parts of this virgin world. And every one of those other actual people will want the land beneath any other player's empire. Within 9 months, an alpha copy floating around the office brings Semper Virens to a standstill. Once the employees get playing, they want nothing else. They stop sleeping. They forget to eat. Relationships are a minor irritation. One more turn. Just one more turn. The game is called Mastery. They spend 2 weeks closing the whole house, Nick and his drive-by visitor. The Des Moines Holes come by to buy Nick's car and take possession of the family heirlooms. They are followed by the auctioneers, who put a green sticker on any furnishings and appliances that might fetch anything. Large men with legible biceps load the movable goods and rusting farm equipment into a 24-foot truck and haul it 2 counties away, where everything will sell on consignment. Nick sets no minimum bids. The accumulated possessions of generations disperse like wind-borne pollen. Then, it's the whole house no longer. My ancestors came to this state empty-handed. I should leave the same way, don't you think? Olivia touches his shoulder. They've spent 14 days and 13 nights closing up a house together, as if, after half a century of planting crops and outlasting the whims of weather, they're retiring at last to Scottsdale to die hunched forehead to forehead over a checkerboard. The bottomless weirdness of the situation keeps Nick up at night. He's going to California with a woman who pulled off the interstate on impulse, seeing his absurd sign. A woman who hears silent voices. Now this, thinks Nicholas Hole, is a real performance piece. People have sex with strangers. People marry strangers. People spend half a century in bed together and wind up strangers at the end. Nicholas knows all this. He has cleaned house after his dead parents and grandparents, made all the terrible discoveries that only death affords. How long does it take to know anyone? 5 minutes and done. Nothing can move you off a first impression. That person in your life's passenger seat? Always a hitchhiker, to be dropped off just down the road. The fact is, their obsessions interlock. Each has half of a secret message. What else can he do but try to fit the halves together? And if they spin out, wake from the dream with nothing, what has he sacrificed but solitary waiting? Nick sits in his ancestors' empty bedroom after midnight, reading by the lantern's low glow. 10 years of squatting in this place, and he feels like he's homesteading in a remote cabin, He keeps rereading the Redwood article in the encyclopedia, the encyclopedia marked with the auctioneer's sticker. He reads of trees as tall as a football field is long, a tree whose stump made a floor where 24 people danced a cotillion. He reads the encyclopedia article on mental disorders. The section on diagnosing schizophrenia contains this sentence: "Beliefs should not be considered delusional if they are in keeping with societal norms." His housemate hums to herself as she prepares for departure. Her frown stops his breathing. She's young and guileless, stripped of fear, with a calling stronger than any medieval nun's. He could no more pass up a road trip with her than he can stop turning his dreams into drawings. He was decamping anyway. Now his life has a luxury he's never had, a destination, and someone to head there with. 2 weeks in a house together in a Midwestern midwinter, and he doesn't even try to touch her. That's the only delusional part, and she knows he won't. Her body around him is untainted by anything so crude as nervousness. She's no warier of him than a lake's surface is wary of the wind. They share a cold breakfast the morning after the auction truck hauls off the last of the whole possessions. They've spent the night in sleeping bags. Now she sits on the white pine floor, near where the oak table made by Nick's great-great-great-grandfather stood for more than a century. Dimples in the floorboards will remember it forever. She's wearing an Oxford shirt with fortunately long tails and panties striped like a candy cane. "Aren't you freezing?"
"I seem to run hot these days, since dying."
He averts his face and flaps his hand at her bare legs. "Could you cover up or something? A guy could get hurt."
"Oh, please, nothing you haven't seen before."
"Not on you."
"It's all the same basic inventory."
"I wouldn't know."
"Ha! Women have lived here. Recently."
"Wrong. I'm a celibate artist. I have a special gift."
"Wrinkle cream in the medicine cabinet? Nail polish?"
She stops and blushes. "Unless you..." "No. Nothing so creative." "Recent women. A woman."
"Story?"
"She took off not long after I discovered the chestnut blight. Scared away. She thought a guy should paint something other than branches now and then."
"This reminds me. We need to house the gallery."
"House?"
His smile twists like he's sucking alum. Memories of the You Store It in Chicago that was home to the great works of his 20s, until he turned them into a large, combusting concept piece. She gets that faraway look, like she's taking dictation from other life forms again.
"How about burying it out back?"
Ancient techniques occur to him. Patinas and crazings, subterranean ceramic practices he learned about back at art school. The idea feels at least as fine as trying to give the stuff away to passing motorists. "Why not? Let them decompose down there."
"I was thinking bubble wrap."
"It's January, you know. However mild it has been, we'd have to rent a backhoe to dig any kind of hole."
Then he remembers. The idea makes him laugh.
"Put some clothes on. Your coat. Come on."
They stand side by side on the rise behind the machine shed, invisible from the house, gazing at a waist-sized hill of scree and the sizable hole next to it.
"My cousins and I were always digging back here when we were kids, heading for the earth's molten core. Nobody ever bothered filling it back in." She surveys the plot.
"Huh. Nice. Thinking ahead."
They bury the art. The stack of photos, that flipbook of a century of chestnut growth, goes in too. Safer there than anywhere above ground. That night they're in the kitchen again, prepping for a morning departure. She more modest, in sweatshirt and leggings. He pacing, filled with that stomach flop feel that comes with leaping into the blue. Half terror, half thrill. Everything scattering on the air. We live, we get out a little, and then no more, forever. And we know what's coming, thanks to the fruit of the taboo tree that we were set up to eat. Why put it there and then forbid it? Just to make sure it gets taken.
What are they saying now, your handlers?
It's not like that, Nicholas. He folds his hands together under his mouth.
What's it like, then?
They're saying, check the oil, okay?
How are we going to find them?
My handlers?
No, the protesters, the tree people.
She laughs and touches his shoulder. She has started doing that, and he wishes she wouldn't.
They're trying to get into the newspapers. It should be easy. If we get close and still can't find them, we'll start our own movement.
He tries to laugh back, but she seems to be serious. In the morning, they set off. Her car is crammed full to overflowing. 5 hours west, they know each other as well as any two people can know each other, short of catastrophe. He tells her as he drives what he has never told anyone about that unscheduled overnighter to Omaha, coming home to find his parents and grandmother gassed to death. She touches his upper arm.
I knew it was that. Almost exactly that.
10 hours in, she says,
You're so comfortable with silence.
I've had some practice.
I like that. I have a lot of catching up.
I wanted to ask, I don't know, your posture, your aura, like you're atoning for something.
She laughs like a 10-year-old.
Maybe I am.
For what?
Olivia finds the answer on the western horizon, bubbling up with distant mountains.
For the bitch I was? For the attentive person I wasn't?
There's a whole lot of comfort in saying nothing.
She tries on the idea and seems to agree. He thinks, if I were ever imprisoned, or trapped in a fallout shelter with someone, I'd choose this person.
At the motel just past Salt Lake, the clerk asks, King or two queens?
Two queens, Nick says, hearing that child's laugh beside him. They take awkward turns in the bathroom. Then they lie awake for another hour, chatting across the 2-foot chasm between the beds, garrulous compared to the 1,000 miles they've just passed.
I've never been part of a public protest.
He must think. Surely some act of political anger back in college. He's surprised to have to say, me neither.
I can't imagine who wouldn't join this one.
Lumberjacks, libertarians, people who believe in human destiny, people who need decks and shingles.
Soon his eyes close on their own accord, and he's swept back into sleep, that nightly place of plant-like deliverance. Nevada is wide and bleak enough to mock all human politics. Desert in winter. He gazes in secret as she drives. She's seasick with awe. Then up into the Sierras, where they hit a snowstorm. Nick must buy chains from a roadside scalper. In the Donner Pass, he gets trapped behind a semi, both lanes thick with metal going 60 on a sheet of packed snow. He guides the car by telepathy, finds a little gap in the left lane, and pulls out to pass. Then, whiteout. Gauze bandages across the windshield.
Livia? Shit, I can't see!
The car thuds onto the shoulder and veers back out. He fumbles into the lane, accelerates, blunders forward, and clears their death by snowy inches. Miles later, he's still shaking.
Jesus God, I almost killed you.
No,
she says, like someone's telling her how things will go. That's not happening. They come down the western slope into Shangri-La. In less than an hour, the world outside their capsule goes from conifer forests under feet of snow to the broad green central valley with perennials flowering on the highway banks. "Callie," she says. He does not even try to fight his smile.
"I believe you may be right."
Douglas has his day in court.
"You are charged with obstructing official business," the judge says. "How do you plead?"
"Your Honor, the official business stank like something steamy somebody's dog left on the parkway."
The judge removes his glasses and rubs his nose. He gazes down into the depths of jurisprudence.
"Unfortunately, that has no bearing on your case."
"Why not, Your Honor, if I may respectfully ask?"
In 2 minutes, the judge explains to him how the law works. Property, civil governance, done.
"But the officials were trying to shut down democracy."
"The courts are here for any group of citizens to seek justice for any action that the city took."
"Your Honor, I'm a decorated veteran. They gave me a Purple Heart and an Air Force Cross. Over the last 4 years, I've planted 50,000 trees.
He has the court's attention.
"I've walked I don't know how many thousands of miles, sticking seedlings in the ground, trying to roll back progress just a tiny bit. Then I learn that all I'm doing is giving the bastards credits to cut down more and older trees. I'm sorry, but seeing stupidity up close in that city park put me over the edge. Simple as that."
"Have you ever been to jail before?"
"Tough question. Yes and no."
The court deliberates. The defendant obstructed a job being done by a private tree-cutting company, on city orders, in the dead of night. He took no pokes at the crew, no destruction of property. The judge gives Douglas a 7-day suspended sentence, plus a $200 fine or 3 days of labor planting Oregon ashes for the city arborist. Douglas chooses the planting. When he rushes from the courtroom back to the motel, his truck has already been towed. The henchmen want $300 to return it. He asks them to hold the truck until he rakes the money together. He's got some silver dollars buried here and there. He busts his hump for the city, planting trees for a week, days longer than his obligatory service requires.
"Why?" the arborist asks, "when you don't have to."
"The ash is a noble tree."
Resilient as all get out, stuff of tool handles and baseball bats. Douglas loves those compound pinnate leaves, how they feather the light and make life feel softer than it is. Loves the tapered sailboat seeds. He likes the idea of planting a few ashes before doing that only thing that anyone really has to do. The harder the man works, the guiltier the arborist feels.
"Not the city's finest hour, what happened in that park."
It's a small concession, but for a man on the city payroll, it's almost incendiary.
"Shit straight. Cover of darkness. Days before a town hall hearing people were planning."
"Life's a blood sport," the arborist says, "like nature."
"Humans don't know shit about nature. Or democracy. You ever think the crazies might be right?"
"Depends. Which crazies?"
"Green crazies. Bunch of them were helping plant a cut down in the Sayus Law. I met some others at a protest in the Umpqua. They're coming out of the woodwork all over Oregon."
"Kids and druggies. Why do they all take after Rasputin?"
"Hey," Dougie says, "Rasputin had a look."
He hopes the arborist won't turn him in for sedition. He doesn't leave Portland right away. He heads back to the public library to read up on guerrilla forestry. His old librarian friend there continues to be more than helpful. The man seems to have a little thing for Dougie, despite his aroma. Or maybe because. Some people get off on loam. A news story of an action near the Salmon Huckleberry Wilderness gets his attention. An outfit training people how to blockade logging roads. All Douglas needs to do is get his truck out of hock. First, though, he must perform a little guerrilla action of his own. He's not sure of the legality of returning to the scene of his crime. Another act of civil disobedience could very possibly land him back in jail. The part of Douglas that likes to gaze on the earth from way up high, like he did when he was a loadmaster, almost hopes it does. Rage builds as he nears the park. It's not quite midday. His shoulders, neck, and bum leg feel it again, thrown to the ground by thugs pulling one over on the general populace. Rage doesn't puff him up, though. Just the opposite. It stoops him over and sucker punches his solar plexus until by the time he's in the grove, he's shuffling. The first of the fresh stumps still oozes resin. He drops down alongside it on the ground and pulls out a fine-line magic marker and his driver's license to use as a straight edge. He holds both to the sawn wood like he's doing surgery and counts backward. The years roll away under his fingers, their floods and droughts, their cold spells and scorched seasons all written into the varying rings. When the countdown reaches 1975, he makes a fine black X and pens in that date. Then he peels back another 25 years, makes another X on a ray just a little bit counterclockwise from the first, and labels it 1950. The work goes on in quarter-century increments until he reaches the still center. He doesn't know how old this city is, but the tree was clearly a sturdy sapling before any white people came near this spot. When Douglas pens in the closest year he can count with accuracy, he travels back out to the rim, so recently still expanding, and writes in block caps that run like a wheel around half the circumference, "Cut down while you slept." He's still there, marking the stumps, when Mimi comes out for lunch. Anger is her new lunchtime card game, played solitaire while eating her egg and hot pepper sandwiches on a bench in the newly minimized Zen garden. Since the night raid, she has made scores of phone calls, attended an impotent public meeting, and talked to two lawyers, both of whom advised her that justice was a fantasy. Outdoor lunch is her only recourse, staring at the raw stumps and chewing her rage. She sees the man on his hands and knees annotating the damage and explodes. "What are you doing now?" Dougie looks up at a woman the image of a Patpong B-girl named Lalida he once loved more than breathing. A woman worth punching any number of potholes to get next to. She advances, threatening him with a sandwich lance. "It's not enough to murder them? You have to deface them, too?" He bares his palms, then points at the hieroglyphics on a cut stump. She stops and sees the labeled rings running backward to the circle's center. The year her father blew his brains all over the backyard. The year she graduated and got this godforsaken job. The year the whole Ma family scattered from the bear. The year her father showed her the scroll. The year of her birth, the year her father came to study at the great Carnegie Institute of Technology. And in the outermost ring, the caption, "Cut down while you slept." She glances back down at the man on his knees. "Oh God, I'm so sorry. I thought you were... I almost kicked you in the face." "Guys who did this beat you to it." "Wait. You were there?" Her eyebrows draw together as she does the yield stress calculation. "If I'd been there, I'd have hurt someone." "Big trees are coming down all over." "Yeah, but this was my park, my daily bread." "You know, you look at those mountains and you think,
civilization will fade away, but that will go on forever. Only, civilization is snorting like a steer on growth hormones, and those mountains are going down.
I talked to two lawyers. No laws were broken.
Of course not. The wrong people have all the rights.
What can you do?
The crazy man's eyes dance. He looks like the 12th Arhat, amused by the folly of all human aspiration. He wavers.
Can I trust you? I mean, you're not here to steal one of my kidneys or anything.
She laughs, and that's all he needs to believe.
Then listen. You wouldn't happen to have $300 anywhere, or maybe a car that works?
The Brinkmans take to reading when they're alone together, and together they're alone most of the time. Community theater is over. They haven't acted in a play since the one about the non-existent baby. They've never said out loud to each other that their acting days are over. No dialogue required. In place of children, then, books. In their reading tastes, each of them stays true to the dreams of youth. Ray likes to glimpse the grand project of civilization ascending to its still obscure destiny. He wants only to read on, late into the night, about the rising quality of life, the steady freeing of humanity by invention, the breakout of know-how that will finally save the race. Dorothy needs wilder reclamations, stories free of ideas and steeped in local selves. Her salvation is close, hot, and private. It depends on a person's ability to say nevertheless, to do one small thing that seems beyond them, and for a moment break the grip of time. Ray's shelves are organized by topic. Dorothy's alphabetical by author. He prefers state-of-the-art books with fresh copyrights. She needs to communicate with the distant dead, alien souls as different from her as possible. Once Ray starts a book, he force-marches through to its conclusion, however hard the slog. Dorothy doesn't mind skipping the author's philosophies to get to those moments when one character, often the most surprising, reaches down inside herself and is better than her nature allows. Life in their 40s. Once any given volume enters the house, it can never leave. For Ray, the goal is readiness. A book for every unforeseeable need. Dorothy strives to keep local independent booksellers afloat and save neglected gems from the cutout bin. Ray thinks, you never know when you might finally get around to reading that tome you picked up 5 years ago. And Dorothy, someday, you'll need to take down a worn-out volume and flip to that passage on the lower right-hand face, 10 pages from the end, that fills you with such sweet and vicious pain. The conversion of their house into a library happens too slowly to see. The books that won't fit, she lays on their sides, on top of the existing rows. This warps the covers and makes him crazy. For a while, they solve the problem with more furniture. A pair of cherry cases to set between the windows in his downstairs office, a large walnut unit in the front room, in the space traditionally reserved for the television altar, maple in the guest room. He says, that should hold us for a while. She laughs, knowing from every novel she has ever read how brief a while can be. Dorothy's mother dies. They can't bear to part with a single volume of the dead woman's titles, so they add them to a collection that would have been the envy of kings. Dorothy finds an incredible deal on Walter Scott's Complete Waverly Novels in a downtown antiquarian bookstore.
1882! And look at these beautiful endpapers! Marble waterfall!
You know what we could do? Ray tosses off the idea on the way to the cashier. Next to the Scott, he slips in a copy of The Age of Intelligent Machines. That funky wall in the small bedroom upstairs? We could have a carpenter design some built-ins.
The plans they once had for that room now seem older than anything on their shelves. She nods and tries to smile, reaching down inside herself for a word. She doesn't know the word. She doesn't even know that that's what she's doing. Nevertheless. The word is nevertheless. They have a standing joke at Christmas, a joke always ready not to be one on a moment's notice. One gift they give each other must be the annual attempted conversion. This year he gives her 50 ideas that changed the world.
Honey, how thoughtful!
Sure changed me.
He will never change, she thinks, and kisses him near the lips. Then she comes through with her part of the ritual. A new annotated edition of 4 Great Novels by Jane Austen.
Dorothy, darling, you read my mind.
You know, you could try her one of these years. He tried her years ago and almost choked to death from claustrophobia. They spend the holidays in their robes, each reading the gift they bought the other. On New Year's, they struggle to make it to midnight. They lie in bed side by side, leg to leg, but with hands firmly on the pages in front of them. Falling asleep, he reads the same paragraph a dozen times. The words turn into twirling things like winged seeds spinning in the air.
Happy New Year, he says, when the ball drops at last. Survived another one, huh?
They pour the bubbles that have been waiting by the bedside on ice. She clinks, drinks, and says, "We should have an adventure this year." The bookcases are full of previous resolutions, taken up and shelved. No sweat Indian cooking. 100 hikes in the greater Yellowstone. A field guide to eastern songbirds. To eastern wildflowers. Off the beaten path in Europe. Unknown Thailand. Manuals of beer brewing and wine making. Untouched foreign language texts. All those scattered explorations, theirs to sample and squander. They have lived like flighty and forgetful gods.
Something life-threatening, she adds. I was just thinking that. Maybe we should run a marathon. I could be your trainer, or whatever.
Something we could do together. Pilot's license?
Maybe, he says, comatose with fatigue. Welp.
He sets the glass down and slaps his thighs.
Yep.
One more page before lights out. She descends into the real anguish of imaginary beings. She lies still, trying not to wake him with her sobs. What is this grabbing at my heart like it means something? What gives this pretend place so much power over me? Just this, the glimpse of someone seeing something she shouldn't be able to see. Someone who doesn't even know she's been invented, staying game in the face of the inescapable plot. For some reason, when their anniversary comes, the Brinkmans again forget to plant anything.